of that grower, so we can get a sense and a personification of at least one component of the opposition and how that evolves.
After the strike broke out in September of 1965 and dragged on through the harvest season, in December, actually by the Thanksgiving, the harvest season is over. So there's no work anyway. There's going to be no work until the pruning, which doesn't start until the winter months of January and February. So, in effect, it is downtime. If you had picket lines, you're picketing nothing. There's no work going on. So the pruning comes, and the winter is very difficult, very cold, very foggy, miserable, miserable. You're picketing. The pruners are there. Some come out, some don't. So Cesar Chavez realizes that something more must be done. There must be a way to break through. And what he and his fellow members decide is that they are going to march to Sacramento, a distance of 400 miles. They're going to march to Sacramento and present their case to the governor and demand that the governor take steps to stop the violence and the intimidation of the strikers and to take a stand. So, on March 17th, 1966, the march to Sacramento begins. But it's not just a march. It's a pilgrimage. It's the theme is peregrinación. The theme is revolución. The theme is penitencia. So pilgrimage, penance, and revolution. And so the group of Delano strikers, about 80, begin the march, March 17th, and they end the march on Easter Sunday in front of the Capitol. Governor Edmund Brown is not present. He's vacationing with Frank Sinatra's at Frank Sinatra's estate in Palm Springs, and that doesn't dampen the enthusiasm of the 10,000 people that gathered to support the farm workers on the steps of the state capitol. And the march that began with 70 people, day by day, grew larger and larger, joined by more farm workers because they marched through all the farm worker communities between Delano and Sacramento. And in the last couple of weeks, the average size of the march was 2,000, 3,000 people. And big enough that they had to close highways and stuff to allow the marchers access. And when it arrived in Sacramento, there were more than 10,000 people who were present. Now, that pilgrimage, the march to Sacramento, is what put Cesar Chavez and the farm worker movement on the map of the United States of America in terms of media.
I'm so sorry. I got distracted. Can you tell me again, what did that march do, what you just told me now?
The march to Sacramento, the pilgrimage, is what put Cesar Chavez and the farm worker movement on the map, the national agenda for the media about movements, about struggle, about social justice. And the farmworker movement became central. That is when, for example, the New York Times began to cover the farm worker movement is because of the March to Sacramento.
Let's pause here and we'll talk more about that march. Walk me through the march, because a lot happens on the way. And one of the things that impresses me most is just the intensity. You know, I've seen the image of Caesar's feet blistered. First of all, tell me about that. I mean, he has to walk. And I don't think people knew it at the time, but it turned out that, you know, he has, you know, one leg is shorter than the other. But tell me about the physical repercussions of Caesar going on that march.
I think of all of the marchers, I think Cesar Chavez was the least prepared to walk 400 miles. Certainly the farmworker strikers were in much better shape and condition to do something like that. Cesar was not in such shape. And they all made the classic mistake of wearing new shoes, shoes that had been donated for the purpose of marching in the March to Sacramento. Well, most of us have had very sad experience in trying to take hikes in brand new boots or shoes, and you frequently and generally do end up with blisters. Now, in Caesar's case, he had two mishaps. First of all, he twisted his ankle at some point early on in the march, right before they arrived at Ducor, I believe. And so it hobbled him a little bit. And then the blisters came. And at some points, Caesar had to take off his shoes and almost walk barefoot in his stocking feet. Or in like sandals to cope with the blisters. And it was suffering, actually. There's no other way to say it. It's personal suffering. He would not quit, of course. He kept marching. But think about it. On a pilgrimage, people do penance. And Caesar was doing his penance, as they all were. But in his case, it really hurt. And it hobbled him. And he had to be helped along the way. Sometimes he had to put his arm around a fellow striker and walk slowly. Sometimes they put him way up in front of the march, like 100 yards ahead, to give him 100 yards head start. Because when the march would overtake him, then, you know, he wouldn't be left 100 yards behind. So it was very difficult for him. And when you think about, I think on some days they did about 18 miles. And if you've done any hiking, and I have, 18 miles is a long trek.
Now, while it was painful, right, I sense there must have been inspiration as Caesar and everybody else came to towns and they were received by their farm workers and housed by them. Tell us how the communities along the route received them.
Everything about the march to Sacramento was organized. So when the march started in Delano, there were four advance people ahead of the march in the next town organizing among the farm worker community about what the strikers would need when they got to town. First of all, they needed to be fed. They didn't bring any food with them. They needed to be fed. They needed to be housed, or they needed a place to sleep, even if it wasn't a house. There was going to be a rally in the evening. At every night, they had a rally at nighttime. And all of the farm worker community, everyone really, but all the farm worker community was invited, and they came and attended, and they listened to Cesar Chavez and Luis Valdez and saw the performances of El Teatro Campesino. And Luis Valdez would read the plan of Delano, which was the revolutionary part of the march. And so when the march arrived to that community, let's say Porterville, for example, they had a welcoming committee complete with music and people lining the streets, and the food was prepared and organized. But those four advance people were already in the next town doing the same thing. And that's how it went all the way up the valley. So, and then as more and more marchers joined the march, of course, the logistics became greater and greater in terms of housing more people, feeding more people, taking care of more people, having a place for the rally. Sometimes it was on the flatbed of a truck, in a park somewhere. Other times it was on a park stage, or other times it could be in a community hall or a church hall. Wherever the advanced people working with the local community was able to organize something where they could meet and be taken care of. So it was a joyous thing, really. Very enthusiastic. There was always music and singing in the march along the way to pass the time. And there were breaks. There were three or four breaks during the day where the marchers could rest. But it was difficult. Spring weather, cold weather, windy, and it's not fun and games. It was serious.
Let's pause here.
Somewhat so that he could set up and figure out the shots he wanted to take. And then after they passed, then he had to race forward to catch up with him. And so it went. Of course, he was an ex-Marine, so he was in pretty good shape.
Yeah, but we got that. So hit it.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was good stuff. I started listening to him.
Nice thing about John Lewis. Okay. Mark it.
Mark.
Something happens on the march. There's a breakthrough, right? And that Cesar gets a phone call. Tell me what happens on this march and this breakthrough and who it is and what it means.
One of the interesting byproducts of the March of Sacramento, and I think that it wasn't pre-planned at first. Jim Drake, who was very, very close to Cesar, one of his associates, who was a member of the California Migrant Ministry, was advocating the use of a boycott. And in those early times, none of us really knew, including Jim, what a boycott was and how it worked. But the idea sounded great. In other words, if you could convince consumers to not buy an employer's product, a grower's product, for example, well, that should have some influence on the grower, theoretically at least. Well, anyway, Jim had some signs made up about Shenley Liquors. Shenley was one of the Shenley Liquors owned wine grapes in the Delano area, and they were on strike. And so he had some handmade signs, and you will see them in photographs, of boycott Shenley, do not drink Shenley, and some of the brands, whatever. Not many signs. But But as the national press and the California press began to cover the march on a regular basis, those signs became flashed on television screens around the country as part of the news. Well, Schenley Industries in New York City, a huge corporation that had this little pissant operation in Delano, California, was not about to sit still for being trashed, their name being trashed in the farm worker movement in this march to Sacramento when there's no need for it. They didn't see the need for it. So they hired Sidney Korshak, who is an attorney who has a reputation, who had a reputation at that time of being a fixer. It was a people that fixed things and brought people together and settled disputes and all manner of fixing. So during the course of the march, Cesar Chavez got a telephone call, not directly, but a message given to him that Schenley Industries wanted to meet and discuss collective bargaining. And this came from Sidney Korshak, whose headquarters were in Beverly Hills. So Caesar was, well, I mean, it was a breakthrough to say the least, but the dilemma was, should Cesar Chavez leave the march? He didn't want to leave the march. This is where his power was. This is where the movement was. He wanted to be with them. They wanted him to be with him. And so he asked permission of the strikers if they would permit him to leave the march for this particular reason. And, of course, they did. They voted overwhelmingly, unanimously, really. And so he had to take a couple of days off, and they went to Beverly Hills with some of his key staff, and they worked out an arrangement that would settle the strike. And that was the breakthrough. And that was the first inkling that Jim Drake's idea of a boycott might be the answer, or might be an answer. And from then on, the boycott began to grow and grow and grow. And ultimately, it became the California Great Boycott that spread not only to the United States and Canada, but even to England.
But that must have been just huge. That was like the first breakthrough victory. That was like the first agreement, right?
Yes, yes. The Schenley's recognition of the union was the first time in the history of California that an employer has recognized a union as a bargaining agent for its workers. It is the first time. Now, so it is a joyous occasion and needs to be celebrated. But when you're there and you say, well, one grower down and 29 left to go, I mean, and absolutely no assurance that the next one is going to fall. Now, the next one did fall, but not right away. And it was only the boycott, the threat of the boycott, really, that even brought the second grower to the table. So that was the DiGiorgio Corporation, headquartered in San Francisco. There was too much work left to do to be able to enjoy yourself too much in celebration.
And what was that work? What was the next thing you guys did?
Well, after immediately following the march to Sacramento, then the farm workers organized a huge march down Market Street in San Francisco, and the San Francisco labor unions really came out and supported it. And we're talking about 4,000 or 5,000 marchers in San Francisco and assembled in front of City Hall, Civic Center. And Cesar Chavez, of course, was the speaker, the main speaker. And that is really what launched the boycott of DiGiorgio Corporation. That's what got it off the ground. And with DiGiorgio headquartered in San Francisco, of course, and especially in that era, the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner were major players, media players, in the whole San Francisco Bay Area. And, of course, this was right up their alley, and controversy and excitement and demonstrations. And after all, this was the 60s, you remember. So that ultimately led to a contract with DiGiorgio Corporation. Not right away. DiGiorgio insisted on secret ballot elections to allow workers to choose the union of their choice. And the farm workers, the Caesars, UFW, at that point it was United Farm Workers, they were on the ballot, the Teamsters were on the ballot, and no union was on the ballot. And the UFW won the election handily and then embarked on negotiations, and ultimately a contract was signed with the DiGiorgio Corporation. So that was strike number two.
Okay. Let's pause here and let them. So let's go back to the boycott part so that we can sort of build the story of the boycott. So after, you know, Shenley, the breakthrough is Shenley, this boycott expands. Tell me about the expansion of that boycott, who's it and who it targets, and how it was carried out.
Well, after the secret ballot elections at DiGiorgio that the United Farm Workers won pretty handily, the boycott expanded to Jamara Corporation. They were the largest table grape grower in the Bakersfield area, huge. And in order to frustrate the boycott, they began to exchange boxes with other growers. And in order to frustrate the boycotters from being able to identify Jamara grapes. So it got to the point where Cesar Chavez and his associates decided that the only possible way out was to boycott all California grapes, just blanket, all California grapes. Well, that is a difficult undertaking because it's one thing to tell consumers and plead with consumers, well, don't buy this particular brand of grapes. But when you're telling them don't buy any grapes, that's a much tougher sell. But they sold it. The way they began the boycott, really, was assigned farm workers and volunteers. By that time, there were many volunteers in the Delano area. And was assigned them to 30, there were 35 major cities in the United States and Canada that handle grapes. They're the largest sellers of grapes, those cities are. New York, for example, Boston, for example, Atlanta, for example, Montreal, Vancouver, Toronto, San Francisco, Los Angeles, et cetera, et cetera. But there are 35 major cities that the research showed they sold the most grapes. So farm worker families and volunteers, from outsider volunteers, were sent to those communities and with the task of setting up shop and getting the supermarkets to stop selling grapes.
How do they do that? I mean, just like, hey, go over there and make them stop. What was the program?
Well, it's community organizing all over again. When you land in the city, if the union has done their job, I'm talking about the union, I'm talking about the UFW, has done their job, you have the names and telephone numbers of maybe half a dozen people in that community that should be supportive. Maybe they will be, maybe they won't be. So your job is to contact them, and they're union members, they're church members, church leaders, union leaders, political figures, student activists, colleges, etc. Well, you begin to build a local volunteer group, a support group for the farm worker movement. And the task at hand is to boycott California grapes. And so you organize picket lines in front of specific markets. You have to select the markets that would be the most vulnerable, especially in the beginning. There might be markets, for example, in areas where there's a lot of where a lot of blacks live, a lot of Mexicans live, a lot of poor people live. You would think, and generally you're right, that those communities would be most supportive of efforts of farm workers to organize, and would not shop or buy the particular product, but. You had to go far beyond that. You had to go to the suburbs. You had to go to the cities where the big markets are, and you had to plead with consumers. So if you're in a town, for example, like Detroit or Cleveland, which is union-oriented or was in that era, was union-oriented, you would get a lot of respect and support from consumers who know what a picket line is and why it's there and that it's important for workers. And so now if it's a town like a city like Los Angeles where it isn't very unionized and there isn't much respect really for unions, then it's a more difficult sell, but still has to be done because it's a very large purveyor of grapes.
As I mean, like you point out, it's a huge undertaking, and with a lot of responsibility. I imagine it must have been almost an alien task for farm workers to send them to parts of the country where they've never been before and make this thing happen. I mean, that sounds like it was just an unprecedented campaign.
Oh, it's worse than that. It's worse than that. Marcos Munoz, a Delano striker, from day one, does not read or write English or Spanish. Marcos Munoz is assigned to Boston to be in charge of the Boston and later the New England boycott. Marcos Munoz goes there, can't read street signs, doesn't know where he is. He finds Boston. He finds where the office is going to be. He finds where Harvard is. He's speaking at Harvard. Now, you talk about courage. You talk about commitment. You talk about personal sacrifice. It is people like Marcos Munoz who built the farm worker movement to what it was. They just would not take no for an answer. Their only role, I figured out once that in the California Great Boycott, there were probably 1,200 full-time volunteers working on the boycott in Canada and the United States. So let's supposing there were 1,000. Let's be conservative. There are 1,000 people who get up every day, 7 days a week, and they only have one mission. They have only one purpose in life, and that is to stop the sale of California grapes. Now, 1,000 doesn't sound like many, but 1,000 people with one goal, one purpose, 7 days a week, that's all they're doing. They make things happen. That's how change comes about.
Take 10, Mark.
So this time it'll definitely help if you incorporate the question. The fast that we're focusing on this film, it wasn't Caesar's first fast, correct?
In 1968, early in February 1968, Caesar and I went for a drive. He wanted to take a drive. Frequently we did that. Sometimes he just wanted to get out of the office and have someone to talk to, and we were friends, and he enjoyed it, and I enjoyed it, of course. So he said, one day we were driving in a rural road, and he said, pull over. So I did. He said, you know, I'm going to try to fast. Having a religious background in religious life for many years, I understood instinctively what he was saying. I didn't know what he had in mind. He didn't really tell me what he had in mind, but he was very concerned. He said, I'm not sure I can do this. I want to do it. He'd been reading a lot of Gandhi, and Gandhi did a lot of fasting. And Caesar emulated Gandhi wherever he could. Learned a lot from him. A few days later, he called an emergency meeting at Filipino Hall, and he stood up and said that he was very concerned about the union's commitment to nonviolence, and he felt that it was eroding, and that people were no longer as committed to it as they had been in the beginning, or as they should be. And for him, nonviolence was a pillar of the United Farm Workers and the farm worker movement. He felt that without commitment to nonviolence, the movement would not be successful. It had to be nonviolent. And so then he simply said, I'm going to go out to the 40 acres, which was about a mile and a half out of town, which is where the union complex was located, and I'm going to fast. And basically, the rest of you can make up your mind what you're going to do. But I know what I'm going to do. And with that, he walked out. So we have a hall full of people. Now, these are strikers, these are volunteers, these are visitors, these are supporters, these are staff members, all unpaid, of course, attorneys, all unpaid. Well, these are strong-minded, strong-willed people, otherwise they wouldn't be there in the first place. And here's Cesar Chavez throwing a monkey wrench into the entire program. The audience was thrown into mass confusion. Some people were upset and started shouting that they were upset and it wasn't right what he was doing, and it was taking away